142 of the Autoblog Podcast. I'm joined this week by Stephen Ewing and Chris Bruce, and we talk about Amazon picking up Top Gear, rumors of Apple and BMW being in talks, this week's news bites, and more. That's all ahead on episode 442 of the Autoblog Podcast. Hello, welcome to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Dan Roth. I'm joined this week by Stephen Ewing.
Good evening.
The prodigal podcast returns.
The triumphant return.
Yeah. And Chris Bruce, quickly making himself a fixture.
I'm back, everybody.
So this week we'll do the garage, and since Stephen has been away for so long, I mean, what have you been driving while you've been away? Because you've been everywhere. You've been all over the globe.
So since we were last on here, I've been all over Germany. I've been all over Michigan. I've been to Portland. I mean, God, I don't even remember the last time I was on here. But so we'll start with Germany. I spent 10 days there on this weird thing that I wasn't really familiar with before called vacation.
Why would you take a vacation to Germany? That sounds like work.
Because I have a bunch of friends that live there. Over the course of the years, friends of mine and various acquaintances have sort of spread themselves out over Germany, which makes it really easy to go there for a week and a half and just kind of drive around and see everybody and like make stops along the way. So like we flew into Frankfurt and then we drove up to Aachen where some of my friends lived. And then we went to Cologne and then we went to Stuttgart and then we went down to Konstanz. And it was awesome. But for the entirety of my trip, Volkswagen was kind enough to give me a 2016 Golf All-Track, which is the sort of like all-road version of the Golf wagon. We are getting it in the U.S. next spring. And based on my experience, I mean, people are going to like it. I did everything with that car. I drove it everywhere. I put 2,000 kilometers on it. I had four people in it with all of our stuff. I mean, I drove it off-road a little bit, too. That car, it's really, really good because it's a diesel Golf wagon, but it rides a little bit more comfortably on the freeway. I mean, on the nice German roads, too, but you can just go and go and go in this thing, and it just eats up the miles, and it's quiet. It's nice inside. My car had the 2-liter TDI engine that we're familiar with here in the States, so it was pretty efficient, too. I mean, we did a little over 2,000 kilometers in total, and I only filled it three times.
Very good.
I think you're burying the lead here. I think you need to tell everybody where you drove the all-track.
Well, I took it to the Nürburgring.
Yeah.
Der Nürburgring.
Yeah, we were driving to Stuttgart from Cologne, and you're on the various autobahns, and we were driving, and I'm like, oh, like that's the Nürburgring over there. Like, there's signs for the Nürburgring, and we looked on the nav system. We're like, it's not far off the freeway, and I'm like, we have to go. I just want to go so I can take a picture of the sign or something, or like check in on Facebook or just something, whatever, just to say that I was there. So we get there and there's all these people and all these cars. And one of my friends is like, what are they doing? And I'm like, oh my God, it's a public day. Like, you can just drive on it. You can pay, it was 27 euro for a lap.
But you could write that off.
Right.
Or could submit.
But
or you could just do it to enjoy it. But,
yeah. Or I could just do it to enjoy it. One of my friends actually bought it for me because I was like, I don't know. We'll see. And I'm like, yeah, I have to. I'm here.
Really? You hemmed and hawed. You were at the Nürburgring and you hemmed and hawed.
I don't know. I was like, I don't know if I should take the Golf out there. And just when I was thinking to myself, I don't know if I should take a Golf, I saw seven kids in a Land Rover Discovery go out on the track. And I was like, okay. And then there was like a minivan full of people and like a Camry, but they don't have, it's not the Camry over there. It's whatever the Camry sort of thing is. I'm like, all right, I think I can take a Golf. And
I think that's the Aventus, right? The Camry.
Aventus, yes, I think. Aventus, yeah. It is the Aventus. But man, was that fun. and the Golf did it. The Golf was great. I mean, it's a higher riding Golf wagon. I put it in sport mode and, you know.
Did you try to go as fast as possible and, like, you know, do a 7-minute time around the.
No. I mean, I drove it sportingly, shall we say, because, you know, I had some friends in the car with me and I wanted to show them like what you can do on a track. But the thing that's weird about it is, I mean, it's every car can go out there. I think the rule is if the car can be plated in the EU, it's legal to be driven on the track. So you can take it out there. So there are these times where you're in a Golf wagon coming up to a blind corner and there are three, you know, 911 GT3s behind you, and they will pass you like with an inch to spare on either side. So you have to have your wits about you. And my friends that were in the car, they're both really excited to be there, but they were also sort of nervous. So the entire time I just kept saying like, okay, you know, we've got a Ferrari coming up behind us on the left. It's going to pass us. Like, it's okay. And I'm like, we're going to do this turn, you know, I'm sort of like talking it out, but it was the best time.
I mean, that's one of those high points, right? Like we have that show, The List, right? That's one of the things on The List. Like that's pretty great.
I had just to check it off the bucket list. It was truly amazing, but I mean, I didn't ever expect to do that. It was great. I was like beaming for the rest of the day. And like everyone that I saw, because I had two of the friends that I was seeing there, one of them, one works for Ford in Cologne and the other one works for Daimler in Stuttgart. And I was just like, I got to go on the Nürburgring. But speaking of the Daimler in Stuttgart, I went to the Mercedes-Benz Museum while I was there, which if you've never been and you have the opportunity, it is a fascinating place. And it's the sort of place where if you have friends with you or family or whatever that aren't super into cars, it's still really interesting for them because a couple of my friends that went with me didn't really care that much. But the way it works is you go all the way up to the top and you see like the first car. And then as you sort of wind down the different levels, there are these little displays on the wall that talk about what was going on in the world, like through history. And then it sort of takes you to a landing level where there's like the new era of Mercedes that you get into, and it shows you the cars and the buses and the vans and all those things. And then you go down a spiral that has more historical facts to see, like, here's what's happening around the world, here's how things are being shaped, and now here was the next era of Mercedes-Benz. And it was really fascinating for me just to see all those cars and kind of put it in the perspective of history. But the friends that I went with said it was really, really cool just because you forget, like, cars have been around for this long and cars are such an important part of our history. So it's a really, really good experience. I did not get a chance to go to the Porsche Museum, unfortunately, but I'm really glad I got to go to the Mercedes-Benz place.
You know, that makes me think too, like that's something we don't really talk about that much, but it's really fascinating is like auto museums. And like, I'm sure out there, there's a bunch of stuff out in the Detroit area. I mean, we have one here in the Boston area that's pretty cool called the Lars Anderson. It's got a lot of neat stuff. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, I always recommend to people that are first time visitors or residents of Detroit to go to the Henry Ford Museum at Greenfield Village. It's really fascinating.
Well, it's more than just cars.
That's the thing is, you know, you have to remember that, you know, it's not just cars, it's manufacturing and it's culture and it's, you know, fashion and it's trends and it's economy and it's all these different facets of the world shape the automotive industry throughout history. And it's really cool to see that stuff. I mean, you look at some of these old Mercedes coaches, you know, from the teens and 20s, and, you know, you park one of those next to an S-Class and it's like, holy crap, that's huge. You know, the old car, I mean, like these massive old machines, you know. And then you sort of see how like downsizing and efficiency came into play. And there's one section of the museum where it has a couple of the old, like the original, S-Class plug-in hybrid concept, which, you know, I was telling my friends, I'm like, I remember when this thing debuted at the auto show and I was like, what, an S-Class with a plug? No way. That's ridiculous. And now, I mean, we have an i3 in the fleet right now that I had to plug in this morning. It's, you know, it's cool. It reminds you how far we've come, in terms of manufacturing, engineering, and just, you know, as people. So definitely go, to any chance you get to go to an automotive museum, definitely go. I cannot stress that enough. But, so back to the Golf,
We got a little off track.
Right. So back to the golf. There was one little quirky part of my trip that I have to discuss, which is, so we were down in the south of Germany and we were staying with some friends' parents. And I mean, everything with the car had been perfect, 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 perfect. And we go out the next morning and I start it and I immediately get the warning light saying to check the coolant. It's low. I'm like, well, how is the coolant low? That's weird. And I open the hood and it's empty. The coolant, you know, reservoir is completely empty. And I look under the car and there's a huge puddle. And I'm like, oh God, like this is not good. So we go, we buy some more coolant, we fill it up, we drive, we get to our next stop, hang out there for a little bit, get back in the car about an hour and a half later, and the reservoir is about half full again. So I'm like, okay, there's a leak. So, you know, call Volkswagen, leave a message for them saying this is what's going on. So I had to get it then back to northwest Germany, which was a 6-hour drive. So we would just go and go and go until the car told us it was low on coolant. Then we'd pull over, you know, do the sort of like concentrate and water mix, and then go and go and go, and then add more over and over again. But so in talking to Volkswagen, I find out that there's specific types of rodents, namely squirrels, that love to burrow up into golfs and chew away at the different hoses.
Just golfs?
I mean, not...
Are these like hipster rodents or something?
Yeah, just golfs. Just diesel golf wagons.
Right, exactly. They're Brooklyn squirrels. So they're squirrels.
Like journalists. Journalists. But that's what caused the leak in the hose, which is kind of funny. But, I mean, aside from that, the car was totally flawless. And I had a lot of people asking me on Twitter about it to say, like, you know, do you think this is going to be a good fit for America? Do you think people here will buy it? I think it's a good alternative to something like a Subaru Outback, maybe if you don't need the space. And if you realize that, like, Subarus, as lovely as they are, I mean, they're not the most quality feeling interiors, you know. The Outback is a nice car, the new Outback especially, but there's just something about the fit and finish of the Golf that's a little bit better, though it is a little bit smaller inside. But I mean, it's not going to sell in huge numbers here, but I think that people looking for that sort of vehicle, or people who maybe, you know, would be Audi all-road customers, can get a cheaper answer with the Golf all-track. So I'm excited for it to get here just so I can drive it again.
I mean, I really like the Golf. I think it's going to be a winner. I mean, I like the fact that they've butched up the. I guess it's the now the Golf Wagon too.
Yes.
Yeah. So
it looks awesome with like the plastic, you know, wheel arch, or like the cladding on the wheel arches, and like the big 18-inch wheels and the slightly different front fascia. It looks really good.
Yeah, which is weird to be saying that, like, a car that's pretty much the opposite of what you'd expect an enthusiast car. Well, I guess it's just a different kind of enthusiast, right? Like, it's not.
Yeah, it's an enthusiast car in the same way that, like, I get really excited about a Forester, you know? Like, I love the Forester. If I were buying small crossover, I would go Forester for sure.
Really?
Yeah, I like the Forester.
But you can't get the Forester with a manual.
Yeah, I know, but you won't be able to get the Golf.
I know, but you can get it with a diesel, so that's weird.
That's weird true. Enough,
you know?
EDI, baby.
You gotta be weird with your car. So is that the only thing you've been driving is the Golf? Or?
No, I mean, I've driven a bunch of stuff. I drove the new Audi TT while I was in Portland. My review of that went up today. Just real briefly, it's the best driving TT yet, like, and not just...
Well, damn well better be.
Well, I was going to say, but it's not just in that it's better than the old one. It's way better than the old one. I mean, the thing is a legit sports car, and it's damn good to drive. And I'm not talking about the TTS. I'm saying the base TT is phenomenally good to drive. So I got to drive that in Oregon. Really pretty roads, really great drive. It's a really good car. Still not sure who's going to buy it. But if you're into TTs and little tiny sports cars that are $50,000, it's a hoot. So I liked that. But the car I drove most recently that I sort of love to hate is the Chevy Corvette Z06.
Why do you hate that car?
Well, I don't hate the car.
Is this the same thing? Is this like your Challenger business where you don't like the Challenger?
No, because I love the Corvette in general. I think the Corvette is fantastic. And this is, you know, this was a white Z06 with the black hood decal and the black roof and the black, like, aero bits because it has the Z07 package and the black wheels. So it looks outstanding. The thing looks so evil and yet so good at the same time. But, you know, everyone talks about how the big thing with the new Corvette is that the interior is so much better than the old one. And yeah, it is an improvement, but it's still not 110 grand good, which was how much.
What else, what else are you going to burn 110 grand on that's going to be that capable?
That's the thing.
And have an interior that nice.
Right. That's the thing. For the money, I mean, Jonathan Ramsey, when he reviewed it, he said this, and I completely agree with him. For the money, they are giving that car away. They're totally giving that car away. But
Ramsey think of the interior?
He thinks the same thing I do, which is it's not nice enough. It's nice. It's very nice. But I expect more. I really, truly do.
Would you give up performance for a nicer interior?
No, I wouldn't. Okay. But I will say I found it very alarming that, you know, the car I had, I drove it over the weekend and I drove it across Michigan and back. So I did about 400 miles in it. Everything rattles. And it's not because of the road quality. I mean, this is on the freeway where it's smooth. The roof, because this has the removable roof panel, when it's latched in, it just constantly is like shaking and creaking. And it's weird to the point where, I mean, I would stop to check a couple times to make sure it was on correctly because it just didn't sound right. There were so many squeaks and rattles coming from various parts of the interior. The infotainment system is really slow to respond. It's not as it's pretty intuitive and it looks clean, but it's pretty laggy, especially when you're inputting navigation instructions. And I don't know. I kind of expect more out of the interior. But again, the car is amazing to drive. It is absolutely amazing. It makes the best noise. It looks killer, and it's just so incredibly fun. I love it.
So, I mean, if it rattles, it's kind of like how Corvettes have always been, right? It's nostalgia.
Sure, but I don't want the Z06, or I don't want the C6 over again. You know, I want this thing to be the best at everything because I don't want to have to think to myself like, well, maybe I would have this instead. I want to live in a world where I can say the Corvette Z06 is the best performance car you can buy.
So, I mean, I think you could get what, so performance doesn't mean luxury. So I think it is the best performance car you can buy, like in terms of bang for the buck.
All around. I mean, I don't know. I just feel like part of that interior should be better. I really do.
Well, I mean, if you want a better interior, you know, you're going to have to sacrifice performance. But, I mean, you can get it in a 911 at that price. Sure. 911's built like a brick outhouse. You see what I did there? I cleaned it up for the kids.
Sure did, yeah.
Yeah.
I did like that. But, at the end of the day, though, the car I had was about 110 grand. I would just rather have four Miatas.
All right.
That's an answer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or well, let's say three Miatas and a GTI for when it's winter.
You can drive a Miata in the winter. It's you know.
You can, but I can't put my drum kit in a Miata.
What kind of drum kit? Do you have a vintage drum kit?
I had an old Pearl Classic.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was great.
I wanted a Slingerland.
That my first kit was a Slingerland.
Oh, vintage drums are the best.
I had a Slingerland. I got it for my 10th birthday.
Wow.
Yeah.
You with the awesome presents. All right. Nobody's listening to this. So I think
what have you driven?
Yeah, I think we should move on a little bit. So I just got out of a 2015 Nissan Murano.
Okay.
And, you know, the Murano is sort of it's an odd man out among Nissan. It's the It's in the same place that the Maxima is, right? Like, you look at it, mm-hmm. and you're like, why does this car exist? But on the other hand, I've always liked the Murano. I think they've done a really good job updating this vehicle. And it was one of the early crossovers that sort of made inroads and conquered suburbia because it had style and substance. It's always driven pretty well. And it's a half step beyond Nissan and not quite an Infiniti. And it, mm-hmm. like, I feel like it's still there, you know? I mean, it's a really nice car.
Where do you fall on the looks?
I really like the exterior looks. I mean, you could say they're a little overdone, but every Nissan's a little overdone. I kind of like it. You know, it's definitely expressive. It stands out, and I like to think of myself as a creative person. It appeals to me because I can see the creativity in the design.
What trim level did you have?
I had the SV with all wheel drive. Yeah. So,
as you know, we have a long term one.
What trim level is our long termer?
Platinum.
Okay, so that's like the top. That's got like the leather and everything else.
Yeah, and the really bad like white wood.
Yeah, see, this one had, I really liked the interior. I can see why it won the awards 10 best in the world interior this year. It won that. Because it's really nice. The interior design is nice. It's got a sort of like a swoopy dash. The controls are pretty easy to use. This had like the silver metal trim, or metal looking. I don't know whether it was metal or plastic or what.
That's better.
Good. Yeah, it looked good. The seats had faux suede upholstery, so that was actually really comfy. And the whole interior was nice. It was comfortable. Has the zero gravity seats and everything, and it felt well put together. So, you know, I think it's the exterior looks great. The interior is super nice, and it was pretty well equipped too. The platinum, what is our platinum probably cost 40, something like that?
44.
Okay, so that has everything.
Yeah, it's loaded. Ours is totally 100% loaded.
So that's not bad when you consider that it tops out at 44. Mm-hmm. This one was 37, and I was surprised. That actually seems like a pretty good deal. It had a bunch of the safety doodads, the stuff I shut off. But it also had like a Bose audio system. It didn't feel lacking. It was missing dynamic cruise control, but it had nav, and all that stuff seemed pretty easy to use for the most part. It wasn't super laggy or anything. So, I mean, overall, this is a solid car. It feels very good behind the wheel. The steering is good. The brakes are good. The ride is nicely done, so it's not floaty or crashy. It handles okay. Like, it's not going to embarrass itself. It feels good to drive. It's not a standout in the driving department, but it does everything that it does well and better than some others in the class. That just feel like they have all the pieces, but they just don't come together. Like this, the Murano at least comes together and it drives like it was designed to. Everything was designed to work together. I guess in terms of gripes, it's got the VQ V6, which sounds mean as hell, but it only makes about 260 horsepower, which was great back in the day when they launched the Murano, and it's still fine. Like, it's not really a big deal. But that's when you start to compare spec sheet to spec sheet, that's not really a lot of power these days. And it's lighter on torque than it is on horsepower. So, it's lacking there if you wanted to sort of point fingers. And, CVTs are still not really my thing. Although this one really knows how to stay out of the way. So it just kind of burbles along on the highway, which was good. And visibility kind of isn't great out of it. You do pay a little bit of a price for the styling. But this is not the only car that I've been saying about, and nobody's listened to me yet. So I don't think that Nissan's going to listen to me either. I guess what surprises me is that this is really proven hardware. Like, it's not like they built like a completely new Murano. They basically took the good pieces that they've been making and they put new styling on it and they put a new interior in it, and it's proven hardware and it's a good car, and like it does the thing that the Murano has always done. You know, it's been a nice crossover for a good price, and now it actually gets pretty good fuel economy too. I got like 26 combined, which doesn't suck. Yeah, considering that it's this large and energetic. I was surprised to find out it has more room inside than like the Grand Cherokee or the I think the Touareg.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's pretty big when you consider it. Like, it doesn't look like it'll be that space efficient. So I was impressed with it. You know, solid effort. I'm not sure that it's really on everybody's radar, but it's one of those vehicles that, and I think the pricing too is good because it makes me happy that the Pathfinder exists, not because I like the Pathfinder, because I don't, but because the Pathfinder sits above this in the model hierarchy now, they can't make the Murano too expensive, which means it's a very good deal.
Right. And at the same time, what I thought was interesting is I went on the launch for the Murano, and you know, the Pathfinder is more expensive, and then there's the Armada above that, but Nissan considers the Murano, in terms of its crossovers anyway, that's its flagship crossover, where they're like, it's not the most expensive, but they want the Murano to be the best representation of Nissan crossover.
I think it is.
I do too. And you look at things like it, you know, you get a couple more premium features that you don't get on the Pathfinder. The seats are a little bit nicer. Everything inside is a little bit better done, a little more stylish. You get LED lights. You can get, you know, xenons on the Platinum model. Everything is just a little bit more premium than the Pathfinder. And then, I mean, the Armada's ancient right now, so we don't even need to mention it. But
I forgot about the Armada.
Right. But it truly does feel like the most premium, you know, most flagshipy representation of what a Nissan crossover is.
Yeah, and it doesn't suck to drive. Like, that's my biggest gripe about the Pathfinder, is it just sucks to drive. The Murano doesn't.
Sucks to drive.
Yeah, we've been down this road. I don't like it. I think it drives.
Yeah, we don't need to go back here again. Yeah,
we should talk about stuff, because we've got stuff to talk about. So let's do that. The biggest piece of news, I think, to come out this week was Amazon has signed the Top Gear guys. So, Chris, are you going to now, like, do you have Amazon Prime, or would you buy it because
they're... No, I have to admit, my wife and I already have Amazon Prime. There was a sale in January, and it was like half price for, there was like a 1-day half price sale. So,
yep, I did that too.
Yeah.
The free shipping's awesome.
Yeah, and that, to be honest with you, that's their streaming movie stuff aren't that great, at least in terms of the free stuff. You know, the stuff that you pay for, there's a lot of options, but I don't really feel like paying $2 or $3 to rent a movie. But the free shipping, it pays for itself. So
yeah, exactly. But I mean, in terms of moves by, it's weird to be sort of on a podcast and you know, a car podcast and just talking about the like media landscape, but like that's a pretty big deal for Amazon when you consider the competition was like Hulu and Netflix. Like, this is a well-liked show, and it's not that it was cheap to get, and it's not, I mean, I'm curious to see what they do with the show, whether it's the Top Gear we all know and love, or it has to evolve in some way.
I am curious to see that too. I kind of have a question for Steve, actually. Shortly after this announcement came out, Steve had a tweet basically saying that he kind of wishes that Netflix had got this show rather than Amazon.
Oh, he's not alone.
And I don't know why. I mean, Amazon's money spends just as good as Netflix does. And
yeah,
if the rumor's true that it's $250 million deal, that's plenty of money to do that show on. Go ahead, though, Steve.
It's because I have Netflix.
Yeah, it was a selfish decision, right? Steve, see, yeah. I have both. I have Hulu, Netflix, and Amazon. I pay for
all of them. I do too, Dan. Yeah.
So,
it was like, so I am perpetually late to the game on anything involving like modern technology stuff. If you ask any of my friends or like exes about this, they'll back that up. But I got Netflix last year, and it was like a big deal for me that I'm gonna get Netflix. I bought an iPad. It was a big thing for me. Like, you have to understand, I don't have. I own like 8 DVDs I've never even, as far as I know, seen
all seasons of the Teletubbies.
No. I mean, I have like a 30-inch non-HD TV just because I don't usually care about that stuff too much. And I was just like, the one time I actually like plunked down on some newfangled thing and it's Netflix, and now Top Gear is going to Amazon. I'm like, damn it. So
yeah, but Amazon, so the thing is, like, Amazon wants to compete. So they, sure. And they've got some good programming. So, we're seeing a new landscape emerge for media. And so these guys are going to be the new networks. They're going to, they're going to duke it out to get the shows. And it's going to be really interesting to see what they do with the shows, how they evolve the content, because they don't have the restrictions that broadcast had, even the BBC,
which was
different than anything here in the US. What kind of freedom that gives Amazon? Because I mean, they've got a lot of shows already that are certain they would never fly here on even on cable.
Right. They can survive on much smaller audiences, at least for the time being.
Yeah,
they can be much more experimental.
Yeah, the pay model is beautiful. I mean, that's the thing that Showtime and HBO figured out, was they make such high quality programming because everybody pays.
Sure.
So if they're getting paid to make the shows, they're not as beholden to advertisers, and they can fund those kind of programming with long story arcs and those kind of things. So I'm really curious to see. Well, first, I guess my biggest question is, is it going to be restricted to the UK? Because the whole announcement was very UK centric. It was a big get for Amazon and the whole thing came out with a statement from Amazon UK it seems like it's to bolster adoption of their streaming service in the UK, and so the US is kind of like collateral damage, I guess.
I'm pretty sure. You're right. The press release did come from Amazon UK, and Amazon UK pretty much that day had like a splash page, like, we've got them, come sign up for Amazon Prime. But I'm pretty sure it's been knocked out that it is going to be US, UK, European deal. Outside of that, I'm not too sure, but I'm 99% sure that we're going to be getting it here.
And why don't we have an Autoblog podcast show on Amazon? We should call them. I think that would be excellent.
Because you and I don't look good on camera, Dan.
Speak for yourself.
And Jeremy Clarkson does.
Yeah, right.
I mean, if you want to stay and shout at the camera all day, I'd love that. But
yeah, I mean, we could do how many episodes could I get out of trying to fix my damn Volvo? I mean, that's a whole season. All right. So that's going to be interesting to watch. No pun intended, but I'll take it.
I mean, do you guys intend on watching it when it comes around? I mean, I'm going to watch it, good or bad, just to see, how it is.
I'm going to watch it when someone manages a way to get it off of Amazon Prime and onto YouTube or something.
Oh, you're not going to have a problem with that.
Yeah, then I'll definitely watch it. But I don't.
Which really bothers me, by the way, because that's content piracy, and everybody thinks that you're not hurting the content creators, but you are. Okay, carry on.
Totally are. I mean, I don't know if this announcement is enough to make me go out and buy Amazon Prime unless there's a sale again. Mm-hmm. But I'm definitely going to watch, or at least follow along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'll check it out. I mean, I wonder if they're going to restrict it to just Prime too, or Prime's going to be the place to get sort of first run episodes, and then they'll roll it out across other mediums.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
I mean, there are reasons for and against sort of putting it on YouTube, like with the official YouTube account. Like, there are reasons for doing that, and there are reasons to not do it. So I want to see what they do. It seems like because there's so much competition there, there's going to be a lot of great programming, and some of it's going to be car programming. And in the end, we win. We pay, but we win.
Mm-hmm. And then Brandon had an interesting follow-up that apparently, the deal's $250 million for 36 episodes. You do the math, that comes out to about $7 million an episode. Do you guys think that's enough to do a Top Gear-like show?
Well, we get $7 million a podcast.
You're not supposed to say that. I want to live like regular people.
I mean, I think it's fair.
Well, I mean, when you look at Top Gear, the way it's been produced for the last 15 years, that was not a cheap show to produce.
Certainly not.
There were helicopter shots. It was all beautifully done, very cinematic. That's lots of hours in the field. That's lots of post-production hours. That's very expensive to do. Mm-hmm. So I got to assume that just an episode of the Top Gear, we all know it cost, you know, a couple million at least, mm-hmm. just per episode. So it, on the cheap side. So yeah, I think $7 million per episode is probably not necessarily outrageous, especially when you get an audience built in.
Yep.
I mean, look at what movies cost, and you're essentially making a half-hour movie, or you know, in the sense of how cinematic it is, and all the pieces that go into it. It's slightly different in terms of production value than a you know, a feature film would be, but you're making a half-hour or an hour-long piece. Every week for a season, that's, if it's a full season, it's 26 episodes, half or 13 episodes. It depends. So, mm-hmm. yeah, that's a lot of work, and that's a lot of, you know, it's not more than just those three guys. There's a whole crew. Oh,
certainly, yeah.
And you know, there's writers and stuff. Which is the thing.
Their producer Andy Willman. He's kind of the fourth member of the trio.
Yeah, he's the fifth Beatle, as it were.
Yeah, he is the fifth. Yeah, but he is signed on to this as well. He's coming over with them. So they, you know, four of the main guys are there. Who knows if the writers from, you know, Top Gear, the TV show, if any of them will jump ship as well. But yeah,
it
seems like they got a good crew at least.
So, at the risk of turning this into the Autoblog Top Gear episode, let's jump and talk about everybody else's favorite subject, Apple, because hooray Apple, and BMW. They have been looking into a partnership on cars, and I mean, I still have a hard time believing they'd be stupid enough to try to build their own car, because why?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Everybody says that Apple is trying to, you know, put together their own car team, and they've made all these hires, and so now they're apparently talking with BMW for some reason. What do you guys think's going on?
I've got a theory. I'm wondering to hear what Steve says first, though.
No, go, because I mean, I agree with Dan. I don't think they're building their own car. I mean, the report that came out this week is that, you know, Apple execs went to Leipzig to watch how BMW puts the i3 together and mm-hmm. you know, its manufacturing process. You know, I think there's a lot of that that's like, okay, this is how you do it, this is how other people do it. I don't think Apple's trying to figure out how to make a car. I think they're just trying to see, like, this is what goes into it, maybe. Mm-hmm. But they're not going to be the ones to do it themselves. But so what's your theory?
So this is kind of pie in the sky, but I'm just curious. I wonder
what kind
if
of pie?
It's Apple.
Okay.
I wonder if they might be curious about Apple's carbon fiber tech, which, you know, the factory that the i3 and i8's carbon fiber comes from is located in Washington, and they're making thousands of tons of that a year. And if I were Apple, you know, they're going to want to be on the cutting edge of tech. You know, they're not going to want BMW for electronics or anything like that. But, you know, BMW has this joint venture in Washington that's making all this carbon fiber. And if Apple really is serious, they're going to want, you know, I would imagine that they would want the lightest, most cutting edge thing that they could build. So I wonder, that's kind of where my mind goes.
Well, and it's probably going to be cheaper carbon fiber than you're going to get anywhere else, just because of economies of scale. I mean, that's the thing that BMW has set up with that partnership, is enough carbon fiber for what they need at a price that they can be profitable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's an interesting theory. I mean, I think that both Apple and BMW would benefit from a partnership if they go at it smartly. You know, BMW doesn't necessarily want to turn over the keys to its kingdom, but, you know, if they can offload, first of all, they both get to burnish their image, because they're two mm-hmm. very well-known brands, very premium brands. It makes a lot of sense to put them together. in that sense. You know, the new BMW, whatever, only, you know, exclusively available with Apple, whatever, you know, whatever the next stage of it is, you know, instead of doing iDrive or giving Apple the sort of the assignment to redo iDrive. That seems like it might be a pretty good trade-off, right? Because Apple's user experience is pretty phenomenal, and BMW's iDrive experience, while it's gotten better, is nowhere near as good. It's good now, but it's still, you know, could always use input from the obsessive Apple UX people. So, I mean, they both stand to win on some level. You know, they can integrate what they do with each other. Apple can see how automakers put their cars together and understand the rigors of the automotive environment and mass manufacture. So if they're going to get into being an automotive supplier, which I think may be more sensible for them to do, then it might make sense. You know, maybe Apple's looking at going, okay, we've got the iPad, the iPhone, the Apple Watch. What's the next big thing? Is it integrating into automobiles? Maybe.
Well, they're making baby steps into that with Apple CarPlay and stuff like that. So there could be an argument there.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's we'll see how it turns out. I can't even imagine what an Apple car would look like, and just the amount of disgusting hubris coming out of Silicon Valley makes me angry as well. So
we've been joking all week. We have the i3 that we have is white. With the black hood, we've joked about putting an Apple logo over the BMW logo. Just to say we did.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you could do that. You take pictures and put it on the internet.
People, the internet?
That's a thing.
It's a fad.
Yeah.
You're a fad.
I mean, that's sort of the two biggest stories. I mean, there were a couple of other things that happened. I mean, we saw that the Chevy Volt now has a little bit more range. Mm-hmm. It goes 53 miles. I was telling somebody that. I was like, I'm kind of impressed with that. And he was like, yeah. That just means the EPA found a 53-mile high cliff to push it off. he was like, the Tesla goes 200 something miles. Even the Nissan Leaf goes, you know, double the range. I was like, yeah, but I don't know. I mean,
I don't know if that's a fair comparison by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, I don't either. I was saying, you know, the Volt cost, what it's with incentives, it's deep into the 20s, like the mid to low 20s. With that $7,500 tax credit. So that's a pretty good deal for a car that does 53 miles pure electric.
That covers most people, you know, that covers a lot of daily drives for a lot of people. You know, that's to work and back for, a good number of people.
That's more than to work and back for me, and I could totally do that.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think... Plus, I think I like the way the new Volt looks. They toned it down a little bit, and I don't know if that's going to turn off some current Volt customers, but I think it's going to bring in kind of a little bit more mainstream people who don't want something quite so polarizing to it. So, yeah, I think I am pro Volt.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those cars that like winds up sort of being on my list of things. That, like, yeah, okay, if I did actually make $7 million per episode, I would consider buying one seriously, because my commute. I mean, I could do the heavy stop and go portion of my commute would be just fine, all electric. That would be great, and then yeah, I could probably do both ways, pure electric on that, and then the highway portions just slip it to. To hybrid mode. So, yeah. I mean, I'm pleased to see that improvement. That's not an insignificant improvement. Mm-mm, going from like 30 something to 50 something. That's pretty good. And so, you know, maybe things are looking up for the second generation Volt. Maybe. Possibly. We'll see. Time will tell.
Oh, God. Only time will tell.
Yeah. All right. So let's do questions. Great. Because we got some good questions. So we'll start with a Porsche question. I can't even pronounce his name, but he dude writes in the Q&A module. Several of his friends have 911s, 991s, and a 993. The only model he can hope to afford is a 996, which that's the one that shares so much with the Boxster. Mm-hmm. And apparently everybody is telling him that's crap, but they're a lot less than the others. Is there any hope that that may actually be a smart investment?
Well, I mean, it's you can't change history. Like, if the cars weren't great to begin with, they're not going to suddenly be great, you know?
But I think it depends on your definition of great. Is a 996 a good... Is a 996 good enough? Is it...
Yes, it's more than good enough.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's still a 911. It's just not the best 911.
Exactly. I think... Isn't the other issue with the 996, don't they have that what is it?
Oh, that's the engine with the IMS failure.
That's the one. Yes, 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 exactly.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of those have been fixed.
Right, exactly. But it's something you need to look into when you buy one.
Those gross-looking headlights.
Yeah, but honestly, that's why I think... So it depends on what you mean by investment. If you want the thing to drive the freaking wheels off it, yes, that is a smart investment because it's going to drive like a 911, which means pretty damn good, and it's going to be inexpensive comparatively. True. And it's still a Porsche, so it's built pretty well. Although that is the generation where they took a lot of cost out of the car, and they got whacked for it, and they sort of put some more premium back into it after. But that doesn't make it a bad car by any means. It was a significant step from the car before it. So there were teething pains, the IMS failures. This is a possible bargaining point, or just something you can look
just
out for.
Yeah,
I mean, at the very least, it's an opportunity to upgrade. Mm-hmm. You put a larger engine in your 996. You know, it's a 90s car for the most part. So when you consider that, then it's not like modifications and aftermarket upgrades are out of the question or as difficult and expensive as they are for modern cars. Mm-hmm. So, like, that's an upside. In terms of appreciating and becoming, you know, like a 930 or something like that, yeah, no. It's probably never going to be that kind of an investment, but that's not really why you should buy that kind of car. That'd be a damn shame to buy it and just, like, sit on it, so...
I mean, the other argument, there have been unloved Porsches in the past. You know, the 914 was unloved for a long time. The 944 was unloved for a long time.
Yeah, the 944 is not unloved as much now. The 924 gets no love. But
yeah, 924 still gets no love. But my point is that these things are kind of cyclical. And if you find a 996 that you really like and you hang on to it, you know, in 30 years... maybe it would be a smart investment. But if you're thinking you're going to buy a 996, drive it around and sell it for 5 years more than you bought it for, probably not, because it's kind of is the unloved 911 right now.
Yeah. And so it's a good bargain. Yeah. So if that's what equals smart investment for you, yes, it's a smart investment. If you want it to appreciate like an actual investment, no. But no car really is. So, all right. You know, we had an interesting question about the GTI, which dovetails nicely with our long-term GTI. So,
yes.
So now that we're having like some ticking noise and reliability issues.
Let me just do a brief recap because we put the story up on Monday. So the car has a little over 10,000 miles on it right now, and we've had it into the dealer twice for two separate issues. One was... The air conditioning compressor line, there was a leak in it, so the AC wasn't working. But the weird one was that there was this, like, random sort of clicking coming from the dash area, like the glove box area, every time you would start the car. And it's been diagnosed as being the recirculation door motor for the HVAC system.
Oh, I thought maybe that was just the time bomb that every Volkswagen comes with.
No. But the whole problem with this whole issue is that we've had some pretty nasty problems with the dealership itself not being able to fix things correctly. Like, they didn't fix the AC right the first time, and then when we brought them the GTI to take a look at the clicking problem, they were like, well, we can't replicate it, so we don't know. But all the people in the comments are saying, like, they should have been able to figure it out just based on your description. But regardless of that, the car is actually back at the dealer. It's been diagnosed. It's being fixed. Everything will be fine. But, yeah, so the question is, you know, do we still recommend the car, you know, given that it these problems? It's the car hasn't been unreliable. I mean, the AC thing is weird, and it shouldn't happen for a car, especially one that just had 7,000 miles on it. And then this HVAC motor thing, the recirculation door motor, yeah, that's curious too. But I don't know. Maybe I'm more forgiving because I really like driving that car so much, and it's not something that's happening across the board. Also, keep in mind the car is new enough that, you know, maybe there'll be a recall issued for something like this.
Well, I mean, to be honest too, like, that's, yes, it's Volkswagen's issue to own, but that's a supplier issue,
right?
Like, and yeah, so I'm sure Volkswagen's rectifying that,
right? I still highly recommend the GTI all the time, and you know, it's not a case that it's happening to everyone. One of my really good friends has a 15 GTI just like ours, and she hasn't had a single problem with it.
You should take the little recirculation valve from her car.
Oh, we should.
But, I mean, it happens. Like, cars, yeah, even, you know, brand new cars, like, sometimes they have issues. Like, I had been seeing oil spots under my Jeep for a little while, and I actually had the dealership check the engine the last time it was in for an oil change. It was like, you know, can you check? Like, did you guys spill oil or what? Like, I've been seeing oil spots on the driveway, and that's all dry. It turns out one of the rear shocks is leaking to the point where, like, it needs to be replaced. And, like, it's got 40,000 miles on it now. So, like, that's, to me, that's still a pretty new vehicle. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I mean, our...
it just happens.
You can read about this in our last update for it, too. But our long-term Murano, I mean, before it even had 1,000 miles, was back at the dealer for a series of problems. The O2 sensor failed. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that went wrong with it. And it's, you know, I generally don't... You know, people harp on Volkswagen a lot, especially, you know, Golfs and GTIs. But, you know, you don't really hear the same things that are like, oh, Nissan reliability. That's not the case. It's every once in a while you just get a car that, you know, something's wrong with it, or there's a problem with the supplier. It's not necessarily, you know, a blemish on Volkswagen. And I still love the GTI. So,
and I mean, being cautious about Volkswagen in terms of service needs and reliability is possibly something that should be in the back of your mind, given just the history and the track record, and, you know, even recent history where, you know, there are lots of camshaft failures and stuff in certain engines and stuff. Like, yes, mm-hmm, pay attention to your research. But the GTI, you know, overall, like, it's still a car we like to drive, and I think it's still a car we'd recommend. Even with some of the, I mean, we still talk about how much we like the WRX, and, you know, Subarus aren't necessarily the most bulletproof vehicles either. Or, you sure know, I still recommend Volvos to people.
Yeah.
And I've got one that's sat for 3 years. I mean, there's that. So, yeah.
It's also hard to extrapolate from just one car.
That, yeah. You know,
the problems affecting one car aren't necessarily systemic throughout the entire model range. So.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So consider your sample size.
All right. So let's see. Oh, there was an interesting question about pickups. The F-150 Limited is here. Do you think that those are going, the domestic pickups like that are going to evolve to be an alternative to premium European vehicles? And I honestly sort of wanted to point out that they already have, and that's why they brought out the F-150 Limited.
Right.
Is that they do replace those vehicles. It's like sort of BMW 5 Series or, you know, big F-150. So,
yeah, I mean, that's what people buy when they want, you know, they really want a luxury car, but they also want a truck. So you buy the $60,000 F-150.
Yeah, because who wants a truck that's going to work? You want, want a cowboy Cadillac. all right, so we got I thought this was cool too. We got someone from Brazil writing in asking. He's a frequent listener to the podcast. He's a GM powertrain engineer. Must be at GM do Brasil. Do we have plans to cover other markets other than U.S. and Europe? So kind of yes and no, right? Like, we've got a few, there are other Autoblog outposts around the world. I don't know how affiliated they are, but they're out there. But we're pretty U.S. centric on our own.
We are U.S. centric because that's where the majority of our readership comes from. You know, we talk about Europe a lot just because there are so many manufacturers that just produce cars in and for Europe. But they have a lot of ties to other global automakers. You know, like, we talk about Renault because there's the Renault-Nissan alliance. So there's, you know, things that
Renault alliance. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, exactly. No, I know. But there are times where, you know, the way we sort of deal with this every day when it's like, you know, here's a car, should we write about it? Mm-hmm. And if there's a way to somehow tie it back to the U.S., or if it's just like a really, really cool car, mm-hmm. you know, we'll do it. Like, we might post on, you know, a version of a Subaru that's only being sold in Japan because it's a version of, you know, a BRZ, and we get the BRZ here. So we always get to kind of post that and say, like, here's this cool version of the BRZ that we don't get, but it's like, here's what's possible with the BRZ. And it's not always speculation, like, will it come to the U.S.? It's just sort of saying, like, here's how other cars are doing in other markets, and here's what other markets are demanding from certain automakers. So,
yeah, I think it would be cool, though, if there's stuff that's going on in a market that you think is Autoblog worthy, to shoot us a tip and perhaps aware. Yeah.
We love that stuff. Do it.
All right. You guys want to spend somebody else's money? We have a nice long email question, and then I think we can split.
All right. Let's start.
All right. So, Glenn writes in, it's time for him to replace his 2003 Grand Cherokee. So he's got about a 15-minute commute, and they do a trip to a weekend place in Vermont, which piles up the miles. They're looking for a used luxury SUV crossover thing around 30,000. On his short list are the RX350, the MDX, and the Grand Cherokee Limited with the V6. So, he's asking for some input, I guess, sort of what we, among those three, what we'd recommend, or would there be something else that we'd recommend?
You said 30,000 is his price range?
Around 30, yeah.
Around 30.
I am going to say I'm really glad that he mentioned this too, because I actually tend to recommend the Acura MDX a lot, especially as a used purchase, because it's a Honda. It's well made, you know? And the MDX, despite not getting a lot of love, is a really good crossover.
I like I don't like the new one as much. It looks kind of,
I don't like the new one as much, but I mean, the MDX, it's sort of the underdog in that class of, you know, you think about, like, oh, well, I'd have this or this or this. And then I kind of am like, no, I might still have the Acura, actually.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I found myself sort of doing the same shopping experience. The MDX, I think it's probably the most efficient and most space efficient. The RX, I don't like at all. I think it doesn't feel like it's worth the money. It's due for an update. The interior feels cheap and crappy. I hate the infotainment system in there. And that's sort of the thing about the MDX too, is like, I don't really like the Honda infotainment, and you're going to be in that thing for a while. It's comfy enough, and it drives well enough, but I don't know that I could bring myself to do it. Obviously, I like the Grand Cherokee Limited with the V6 because that's what I have. I do like the way that drives. The Honda is probably going to be the most efficient of those, though, the Acura. The RX350 would probably be second there in terms of fuel economy. So if that's a concern, you should definitely drive them and see what your impressions are. But I think, Steve, you're probably right on in terms of the MDX being the winner, especially like objectively on paper. I don't know if his budget's going to allow him to get the one with the 8-speed auto, but certainly the earlier MDX is no slouch. That's a popular vehicle. It's a nice vehicle. I'm just trying to think of like alternatives around 30K that we're missing, because we're missing something. I feel like we're missing something.
I feel like we are too.
I mean, there's other. I mean, if fuel economy is a concern, you could look at something like the Equinox with the four cylinder, but you'll probably not like it.
You'll probably. Yeah, but the Equinox is so dumpy. It really is. The Equinox is just a dumpy little thing. Like, it's perfectly fine. It's just not very interesting.
I gave high praise to the Murano at the beginning of the podcast.
Yeah, the Murano's nice. Or even, like a loaded Ford Edge is good.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the Edge has its moments.
I will bring up again, because I do like a lot, Subaru Outback.
I mean, in Vermont, like that's like the standard car of Vermont.
You have to.
I mean, I still really like the Jeep, but 30K, like, mm-hmm. So you're going to spend all of the 30K to find a nice Limited that's not too old, that has, you know, lowish miles on it. I mean, there's a lot of choices there, but I think the MDX is possibly the one you should go spend some time with and see what it's like, and definitely sort of look at how they do in long-term reliability and that kind of stuff. Because we drive a lot of new cars. We don't necessarily have the dope on what lasts pretty long, but I haven't heard too many horror stories about the MDX. So there's that. The RX, you know, his wife drives an IS250. I didn't mean to hold out information, but he likes the IS, which is not the same as the RX, obviously, but it, you know, in terms of Lexus reliability, they have experience with that. So that's true. That's something that the RX probably brings to it, because it's basically a crossover Camry. So
yeah,
and that's not terrible, but I have a hard time feeling Lexus-y in that car. So,
sure.
Again, I'm sure we missed something, so there'll be something that someone can write in and tell us how badly we missed it. Like, last week we had somebody asking for a vehicle for his mom that was, like, all-wheel drive, fit for somebody who's a little bit on the older side. So, we completely forgot about the Venza. So,
because it's dead.
Well, yeah, but it's not as dead as the Accord Cross Tour that I recommended.
No, they're just as dead.
The Venza is less dead, isn't it? I mean, they're both
they're equally dead.
Yeah, all right.
They're equally dead, and they're equal. Never mind. I wasn't on that show. I'm not going to go back to it. But they're equally dead.
All right. Well, we'll continue moving forward. And we'll just say that the MDX is what you should go drive, and then tell us what you don't like about it, and we'll punt. So yeah, that's it. Podcast 442, and I never made an Oldsmobile reference, so I'm going to make it now. And so 442, you guys know what it stands for?
It's the Olds 442.
Yes. Well,
yeah, but what does the number stand for? What is it? Four barrel, four speed, dual exhaust.
Very good. Very nice. Good. Nice. It was also the exchange for my home phone number when I was a kid.
Also, you'll be very happy to know that the Toyota Venza is still listed as a new car. On
yeah,
Toyota.
You can buy it.
It's a 2015, but it's being phased out. It's
yeah,
dying.
But the Crosstour was smothered like a while ago.
No, it wasn't. We had one in the office like a couple months ago.
Really?
Yeah. That actually was funny. The day that Honda officially announced the Crosstour was dying,
it showed up.
Yeah, and it was black too. So I was
saying it was just like a funeral car.
We can't do any better than that. So we should just end the podcast.
Man, I'm gonna build and price a Venza.
You have fun with that. I'm gonna go. So all right, that's podcast 442. Thanks for listening.
Thanks guys.
You can subscribe to the Autoblog Podcast in iTunes, send us an email at podcast@autoblog.com, or find us on Twitter @AutoblogPodcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.